Hi, everyone. Welcome to our podcast, Breathe In, Write Out, a podcast for high school, college, and university students about making the most out of academic life. We touch on study skills, student life, career transition, overall well-being, personal development, and other topics that impact young adults. At the end of each podcast, we send our listeners off with a short guided meditation and writing prompt. We hope that through these discussions, meditations, and writing exercises, we can build an open, caring, compassionate community that supports personal growth. I'm Lisa Pfau, the founder and CEO of Pfau Academic Writing, where we focus on teaching young adults the communication skills necessary to reach their full potential on the page and in life. Get into a cozy spot, grab your pen and notebooks, and let's meet our first guest. This week's episode is about anti-Black racism. What is it, and what does it mean for a more inclusive society? Unfortunately, even after the civil rights movement in the U.S., Black Lives Matter, and countless acts of civil disobedience and protest, racism persists in Canada and the world. More recently, we've been hearing about anti-Black racism, but many people do not know what this means. We thought this topic would be important for students who want to become Black allies and do what they can to fight against structural racism. Today's guest is Jemima Amos, a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Windsor and an editor and coach at Pfau Academic Writing. Her PhD dissertation focuses on the encounters of African immigrant women with their labor market in Canada. She adopts an approach that reiterates intersectionality of race, gender, and class. She is also working with a research team to develop an online course that will teach students how to effectively intervene when they witness an act of racism. Welcome back to our podcast, Jemima.
Thank you, Lisa.
We've already recorded a podcast with you about what is sociology, theory, method. So anybody listening, if you're interested in sociology, I recommend checking that one out. We get into this big, long discussion of like theories and methods and values and what the heck is sociology, because it's so broad. And so I guess this is one aspect of sociology is, you know, anti-Black racism, critical race theory, kind of what you're studying, the intersectionality of race and gender and class and all these different things. So I know you're working on a project right now at the University of Windsor related to this topic of anti-Black racism. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. The project is titled Activating Bystanders Against Racism. And what we're really trying to do is develop a course which would be delivered sometime next year to, I think it's second level or third level, I'm not sure. But the idea is to start the conversation about being active bystanders. So the University of Windsor has something on the bystander initiative, but it has been used towards sexual violence.
Okay.
And what we're trying to do is adopt the same concept of being a bystander, but applying it to a different problem, which is anti-racism. And just to give a little bit more context, bystander anti-racism is understood as actions taken by ordinary people in response to incidents or interpersonal or systemic racism. Mm-hmm. So currently, as we know, people who are targets of racism carry most of the burden of anti-racism.
Okay.
Our goal is to shift the burden from people who are targets,
right,
by activating bystanders to take personal and social responsibility.
Mm.
And we have a lot of evidence that shows the importance of teaching appropriate intervention skills and confidence to enable effective bystander anti-racism. And in existing literature, we've also seen great promise about the bystander initiative and how we can adopt this to stop the perpetration of racism, to reduce its escalation, to prevent physical, psychological, and social harm as a result, and also to strengthen broader social norms that should reduce racism in the future. So we really think that this is something that would, this has great promise in terms of fighting and trying to address this issue. And so that's basically the general gist of what we're trying to do with this course.
I think that's great. I think it really speaks to the missing piece. I mean, Black Lives Matter is not new. It's kind of came about again more recently, and we saw more of a movement this time on social media. We saw protests about defunding the police. But this raised more debates or misunderstandings, I think, amongst, and even like myself, you know, I felt like I needed to get more educated about this, and I don't consider myself, or I would not want to be racist, but I think what you're doing is really important, because I think this is kind of perceived in some ways like not my problem. Like, if I was a person like myself who is not Black, and I'm not aware of my privilege, which I think I had to think about in this recent, during these recent social movements, because people were posting resources and talking about, I had never heard about allies before this, you know, I never really thought, I thought like, you know, well, I have Black friends, I'm not thinking about or consciously aware that I'm acting or thinking in racist ways. And I thought, well, you know, that's enough, right? And so I think the whole what's come out of this and what you're working on is saying like, well, no, we can't fight this battle by ourselves. Like you said, like, not only are is there racism happening, and that's like harmful and hurtful, and you're having to protect yourself, you're also are having to be the voice, like the educator. And I know people felt really exhausted during this last kind of campaign where people wanted to say be allies, but they don't know what that means. And then they're kind of looking for answers. But meanwhile, the Black community is going through this severe trauma, and trauma that has been going on for centuries, and, you know, really painful, and it's just repeating. I can't even imagine the frustration of just having this repeat again and again and again. And so I think this is a really important thing to do, to start educate. And I think partly because people don't know what to say, they don't know what to do, they don't. Even if you want to help, you're not sure. Like, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to do the wrong thing. So this is really, really interesting. And so will this course be, because for example, there was a course at the University of Alberta, which I think I posted about and I recommend it. And it's about, Indigenous issues, and it's a free course. So you can learn about Indigenous history, Indigenous issues, how to be an ally. Daniel Levy, who's a kind of Canadian actor, posted a lot about this. So do you think this course you're developing also be out there for the public, or like, you have no idea, it's too early?
So one of the things we've already talked about in terms of our deliverables is that we're going to be making a press book. So when this is out, the information will be out there. And in terms of the project itself, we consider this as the first of many to come. So we're to deliver our write-up, our findings by February, but we have plans to continue this even beyond just developing this course. So with the press books, with publications, possible publications, we definitely have plans on disseminating like important information from this course, and the possibility of that being available is also something, it's also something in works. So we're really looking forward to what this looks like at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's kind of go back, because as I said, like, for me, I am still learning. I'm always, and like this whole like anti-black, what is anti-black racism? Like, I think a lot of people are like, what is this? Why is this important? What does this mean? Where does it come from? You know, specifically, why is it anti-black racism, not just anti-racism? Like, can you kind of explain a little bit this concept?
Absolutely, absolutely. So in the context of the Canadian society, and I mean, to a large extent, we can make some generalizations. Anti-Black racism is just really this policies and practices that are deeply rooted in institutions. So the educational system, the healthcare, the justice system, that mirror and reinforce beliefs, attitudes, prejudice, stereotypes, discrimination towards people of Black African descent. So talking about oppressions in social institutions are things that we really try to table as issues to discuss, and we can't really shy away from these issues anymore. Right. So we ask things like, what does systemic oppression and resistance of the marginalized tell us about the concept of, say, the nation, nationhood, citizenship, citizenship responsibilities, identity, belonging? These are broader questions that we all ask when we try to unpack what anti-Black racism means. But in terms of the origin, I think it was first expressed by Dr. Akwa Benjamin from the Department of Social Work at Ryerson University.
Oh, wow. Canadian. Yes.
Canadian, exactly. And it seeks to highlight the unique nature, again, of systemic racism on Black Canadians, as well as the history, the experiences of slavery, of colonization of people of Black African descent. So the Canadian perspective, since we're talking about here.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's important, because I think people think, well, Canadians, they're not really racist like Americans. Like, we don't have this problem, you know? And only in recent years, when we have more discussions of Indigenous issues, we have more discussions of anti-Black. Now this is kind of like coming out, you know, like, yeah, we're politically correct, but we're subversively racist. Like, so really interesting that this is a Canadian, it came from a Canadian scholar. And yeah, so important. And because again, we don't talk about this. We don't think like we're multicultural, we're welcoming, but there's a lot going on in institutions or under the surface that we're not aware of. I think when I say we, I mean, as someone that was sort of, I don't know if you want to say a settler, or was born in Canada and have been here for generations and is white, and you know, I grew up in rural Alberta. Like, this is not what people are talking about in rural Alberta. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even as, so this was one of the things that I found really interesting, even as a Black person coming from Nigeria to Canada,
right,
again, some issues just aren't as relevant. So living in Nigeria, I didn't necessarily have to deal with issues of racism. And so coming to Canada, it was like, oh, this is a thing. And this is something that I would have to deal with, and I would have to have these conversations about. So it was very interesting at first listening to people talk about their experiences and how they had to, say, maybe stand up against someone in a classroom, or they had to do this, or they had to do that. And I remember for the first few months, I was just looking like, I couldn't relate, right?
Yeah.
But it's also interesting to know that, to see how quickly you can become a part of something, even though it's not necessarily your experience. So that was something really interesting for me at the beginning. And I mean, with time, I got to understand more about how it's implemented or how it's affected here. I mean, I did sociology in my undergrad, so right. I'm very much familiar with colonialism and imperialism and right. all those concepts. Those are things that I engage with on a daily basis.
Right.
But the idea of being racially attacked yeah. in person.
I mean, what is that experience for you? It must have been really strange what is your experience, and like, has it changed? Because now you've been in Canada for a while. You said you arrived here like, I don't identify with this. And what has been the experience over time?
So for me, it became very important to join the fight. It didn't necessarily have to be something that I had experienced, because that's another thing with, I think when people try to make distinctions between racism in the US and racism in Canada, I think right. one of the things that causes maybe confusion is more overt expressions of racism.
Right.
In the sense that you may not necessarily have someone yell at you on the street, mm-hmm. but there are more subtle expressions. Mm-hmm. There are hidden ways that people still find a way to express discrimination or their discomfort yeah. or displeasure or whatever. So for right. me, I didn't go about looking for a very in my face experience. I didn't need to have right. that to understand that this was still right. an issue, and this is still an issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
So it was enough for me that people had experienced it, and that was really just enough for me to join the fight and do the work in whatever way that I can. And even when I started thinking about my project, my dissertation, and African immigrant women, I initially wasn't really focusing on race.
Okay.
So again, this is where intersectionality comes into place. Right. So I would largely think about it in the lens of gender.
Okay.
And the family, and maybe the public, the private sphere, the labor market. But when I started doing my own research and my own literature reviews and my own studying about the context, the Canadian context, I quickly realized that there's no way I'm going to be talking about African immigrant women in the Canadian society without addressing issues of race, in addition to gender, in addition to class, in addition to status, so immigration status, in addition to disability, in addition to, so that's where the term intersectionality really comes into place, examining these different facets of power and how they all come together to shape the experience of people.
Right. That's really important, I think, for people to be aware of how yeah. how these pieces fit. It's just not simple. It's not simple.
Yes, I think
what I'm curious about is, and this is more of a personal question, how do you think coming from Nigeria to Canada, and then learning more, hearing people's stories of racism, how do you think this affected your identity as a Black woman, or did it?
I would say it made me very aware of my identity, my place, my belonging, if that I think belonging captures what I'm trying to say. And it's something that, I mean, when I talk about identity, it's something that we're constantly negotiating. It's not fixed, right? So in choosing to join this fight or join this cause, I'm finding ways to constantly negotiate, to express, to inform, and it's a process. It's a process. It's a process. I wouldn't say that I've gotten to any like stop point. I would say that it's an ongoing process, and with every chapter, with every project, I'm constantly reinventing and redefining what my identity is in terms of being a Black person here in Canada and what that means for me. A year ago, I wasn't necessarily thinking about things the way I'm thinking about them now. So say even being on this project, for instance, and trying to develop something that we can use has changed my perspective on things, right? So it's a constant process.
Yeah, interesting. So after being in this project, like you talked about coming from Nigeria to Canada, there are a lot of things you didn't think about because you had a different experience as a Black woman in Nigeria versus a Black woman in Canada. And now you're working on this project and it's making you think even more deeply about things. So given that, what could you share with us, the listener, what do you kind of, and I'm sure there's a ton of them, mm-hmm. It's like kind of what's coming up is some gaps that you currently feel exist in Canadian society when it comes to combating racism.
Okay, so just top of my head, I think about the concept of multiculturalism. So the problem is not necessarily with multiculturalism itself, but adopting it without recognizing the necessity for critical anti-Black racism.
What does that mean?
Okay, good. So you know how people would say, oh, but Canada is a multicultural society, oh, but Canada is welcoming, Canada is open, and we have policies that try to integrate everyone, really. Canada is a welcoming society. Yes, to a very large extent, that's a true official statement. But we can't just accept that and make that the end of the story. So while we say, okay, yes, officially, we have a policy of multiculturalism, which to a very large extent we try to implement, we have to look at the reality of the lived experiences of people, right? So despite the good intentions, is this policy really effective in addressing broader questions of structural racism, social oppression, domination, marginalization of peoples in society? Right. So these are things that when I say critical, we need to be critical of it. We need to think carefully about how we're using this policy and how it shapes, because a lot of people really think that Canada is all rosy and all welcoming and everyone is welcomed with an open arm, or you know, but that's not really
what we learn in school.
Exactly. And there is a denial, which I think we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're like me and grow up in rural Alberta and there's really no diversity.
Exactly.
What do you got except a textbook?
Exactly. You know,
so why wouldn't you believe that?
So I think that there are profound social problems that racialized communities confront daily. Employment, education, housing, law, the justice system. And if we keep dwelling on the idea that this is some kind of, not perfect, but this is some kind of nice, it's almost like a utopia where we're not really wanting to look at the reality and the facts. And then the whole idea that people like to make comparisons with the US and but at least we're better. Right. So those things, though, I think that those are major gaps that we are trying to fill. We're trying to say, okay, you know what? How about we take a step back and we examine these policies and these practices very carefully? How do they actually translate to the daily lives of people living in these communities? right? Which is where I think like most of the critical thinking comes in, like unpacking this concept and seeing what it actually entails.
Yeah. So I mentioned, we learn about this in school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're fortunate in a way to, well, I'm in Toronto, you're in Windsor. I mean, I'm fortunate to live in Toronto because it's a very different world than living in rural Alberta. And then you're exposed to different people, different stories, you witness things on the street that mm-hmm. you don't see in a lot of Canada. A lot of Canada is not Toronto.
Yeah.
And relies on like education, curriculum, that kind of stuff. So how could we, now this is like a longer step, right, for your project, right? But how could we apply these concepts of anti-Black racism and advocacy in education? Like what kind of change? I mean, you didn't go to school here, so this might be a tough question, but what do you see? What do you recommend?
So we've had conversations, our research team, and this is one of the issues that came up. And for those that schooled here for like their earlier years, so there's first of all, the lack of courses that speak about Black history.
Yeah, I think there's zero. I don't know.
It's like completely missing.
You know, in my experience.
Completely missing. And then for the few institutions that are trying to, you have Black studies as a separate entity instead of incorporating it into other disciplines.
Mm.
And
yeah.
And this is something that is just overlooked. So by policymakers, by researchers, by educational stakeholders, it's completely overlooked. And there is also the issue of the lack of representation in the classroom and how this now lays the burden on Black students to try to fill in these gaps in knowledge. So you would hear people say things like, oh, I spent 3-4 years and not once did I learn about an important or a notable Black person in history. So I had to go out there and look for this material myself to educate myself.
Right.
Whereas this is something that should be taught in the classrooms, should be shared to everyone, Black or white or whatever color, right? This is something that people should be educated about. So
right.
those are two ways that I really think we can apply some kind of advocacy in our educational system. So we need more representation, we need more courses, and we need them to be incorporated into disciplines, not as separate courses where it's only if you're doing a particular course or a particular, like maybe if you're studying sociology, you get exposed to maybe critical race theory and things like that. But
right.
if you're doing a completely different discipline, you have no contact whatsoever
right.
with these issues, right? So that's what I think.
That's true. That's a good point. You know, and this just made me, when you were speaking about not learning about any notable Black people in history, and not having it separate. You know, we have like Black History Month, but in a way, Black History Month is then just like, okay, we're just going to talk about this for a month. But if
exactly.
you think about it, I'm just reflecting. Yeah, if you look at what, and I haven't been in high school for a while, so things could have changed, but just even working with students, you just kind of think like, well, there's no Black people, Black people weren't here in Canadian history. Like if you just look at the curriculum, but then if you think about like, inclusiveness, yeah, wouldn't you want to hear everybody's story in history class? Wouldn't you want to be sitting in history class or whatever class hearing it? I think history is a most likely place, or maybe English class, you know, even English. Why are we not, I mean, okay, yay, we read To Kill a Mockingbird, okay, but there's other Black literature, like, I mean, again, where are the voices? And And I think you're making a really good point. And like, so I grew up in rural Alberta. I think there was like one Black person in the whole school. But does it matter if there's one Black person and like 60 white people? Why can't it just be distributed more equally, the lessons we learn and the people we learn about in history and literature and stuff, so that it's more inclusive? Because as you said, you were talking about, okay, we have this idea of multiculturalism, but are we really operating in a multicultural way? And so that's a really big piece. And I think because a lot of, you have to remember, a lot of people go to college, they don't go to university, they do technical things. And so this kind of education system is the place where a lot of people would learn about this stuff, because you have to go to school at a young age. So good point. So for those of us who have long graduated from high school, even if they change the curriculum, we're not going to benefit from it at this point. What can we do to be allies? Like, what should we know? What should we learn? What can we do? How do we do it in a way that doesn't put the burden on the people who are actually experiencing racism?
Okay. I have 3 points. Mm-hmm. The first one is to acknowledge how racism has shaped you or shapes you.
Okay.
And I think this is perhaps the most difficult part of doing allyship. Okay. I say doing because I think it's an action. I think being an ally is more pronounced in the things we do than in our words. So pointing out anti-Black racism is often meant with argumentation, denial, like I said, defensiveness, people putting up walls.
Right.
And while there are some people, so people from the majority groups who are committed to disrupting the racial order, some people have just developed these narratives of denial, erasure, distancing, while others choose to believe like whatever they want to believe, right? So acknowledging that this is a reality and how this shapes or has shaped your own life is the first step. The second step, of course, is to educate yourself. Black history, Black education, there's so much information out there, so much that at this stage, ignorance becomes unacceptable. Like there is just a lot of material out there to learn, to unlearn, to relearn. And changing social norms towards the intolerance of racism is one of our desired outcomes in the Bystander Project. And then one of the key long-term outcomes is to establish anti-racism norms. And when bystanders speak up, it means that it may be, when bystanders speak up, it may be possible to establish these norms, right? But on the other hand, inaction means that the prejudiced opinions of the perpetrator are given airtime. And this also influences other witnesses. And we just end up maintaining our pro-racism norms. Nothing changes, right?
Which
also highlights my third point on how we need to speak up and we need to do our part. Now, most people would refrain from direct expressions of racism, like I said, but people would often condone, they would overlook, they would be patently unaware of the fundamental ways in which societies, like our institutions, contribute to social inclusions. And so things like the lack of recognition of international credentials, the lack of to ensure the accessibility of public services for all, right? Lack of policies to ensure greater representation in decision-making. So these are all systemic ways that, it becomes hidden, but it's there. So there has to be a recognition of that. And then also in speaking up, again, like I said, when we speak up, then it becomes possible to actually address these issues. But I think that for these 3 points, what I really want to stress is being an ally is a process. There is no manual, there's no step-by-step procedure or step-by-step guide that says this is what you should do. So I really think that the intention is what is most important, and people would figure it out eventually. So you don't have to get it right at the first instance.
Right. Yeah, because I think that's scary.
And a lot of people really don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can become overwhelming when you're not even sure if you're doing the right thing, or you're not sure what to say, you're not sure how to step in, which is why I think it's a process. And if you take it one step at a time, if you educate yourself, and if today you say the wrong thing and you learn, you unlearn. And it's an ongoing process, and no one should think of it as this thing that, oh, I have to get right immediately, and if I don't get it right immediately, I'm a horrible person. No, that's really not how it is. Just think about it more of as a process. As long as you have the intention and you put in the work to actually intervene and be a good ally, then I think we'll all be fine.
I think that's really reassuring, because I think there is this thing of worrying about saying the wrong thing. It, especially, I think, maybe within the Canadian cultural context, which really values political correctness, right? Yep. So you might know, like, okay, this isn't exactly right, but I want to be politically correct. And then that's maybe, like, why people get a little bit, stuck.
Exactly.
So I think I really like what you said about intention. It's about your intention to learn. It's about your intention to get educated. And to just keep moving forward, and it's okay to make mistakes. So when you were talking, this reminded me of a situation, and people may have had this similar situation, so I just want to share it. I had a roommate, and he's still alive, a young Black man in his 20s. And at the time, we lived near a subway station in Toronto, St. Clair West. And there was a shooting, someone with a gun, and he was identified as a Black man in dreadlocks. So my roommate at the time was walking back home, and some police stopped him. He didn't meet the description of this guy, except that he was Black. He didn't have long dreadlocks. He doesn't look like a guy running around with a gun. None of these things. And I was in the apartment, and I could see on the street the police, like, interrogating my roommate. And I was like, hey, so-and-so, like, what happened? And he said, blah, 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 explain the situation to me. And I'm like, that's racist. That's racial profiling. And I'm like, I'm going to go out there and, like, tell these police officers. But his response to me was really interesting and kind of sad. It was like, no, Lisa, don't do that. This is just something you have to get used to as a Black man.
Mm.
So how would you respond in that situation as someone who wants to be an ally, but also doesn't want to put your friend in an awkward situation? Because he's coming from a place of fear, right? Don't get into this. You're going to make the situation worse for me. And that's how he's learned to cope. So, like, what could I, in that situation, I was just like, respected his request and like, okay, fine. Like, I'm mad about this, but if you don't want me to go say anything, I won't. So, like, what would you guys say about that as you're developing this course?
So if I was in the same situation, I would probably have done the same thing that you did, which is respect his wishes. But one of the things we actually are focusing on is when we talk about learning, unlearning, relearning, we're not only trying to educate white people, right? So even Black people have a lot of unlearning to do. And it's understandable that someone that has been racialized and has been traumatized for years and years and years and years would eventually come to accept it as a norm. It's very sad, but I can see how that's where he would go to, right? So a lot of parents would teach their children to keep their head low and not try to instigate anything. And if someone does anything to you, just keep your head low and come back home.
Yeah, you heard that a lot with the US shootings, right?
Exactly, right? So, and that's one of the sad realities of how things are today. And those are one of the things that we're trying to unlearn. So the education doesn't just stop at members of the majority. Even the racialized people, even the traumatized people have a lot of unlearning to do. Now, again, this has been going on for centuries. So it probably would not take just sitting in a classroom for a few months to unlearn and change the way that we think about such issues. But it's definitely a first step. It's definitely a first step. I think that having a conversation with him, for instance, might not immediately change his approach, but it might get him to start thinking about things a little bit differently. And we're in a somewhat different climate now, where a lot more people are getting comfortable with speaking up and speaking for people. And so I think eventually, hopefully that's the plan. We don't know how long it's going to take, but hopefully even Black people are able to unlearn, are able to think about these issues differently, and are able to also stand up for themselves. But while that's going on, it's important to have allies. It's important to have people who may not necessarily have the same experience, but can empathize, can say, okay, you know what, don't do that. Don't talk to him like that. That's not a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
It's a process. It's a very long process.
I think I did have a little conversation, but I didn't want to like push him. It also made me aware, because I don't feel afraid of the police. I would never feel afraid of the police. I will just tell the police, hey buddy, like, I mean, I'm not going to be like a jerk, but I would say like, go up and tell them there's a problem, or like, I don't like this, or that's, I'm not afraid like somebody's gonna arrest me. Yeah. And even if they did, I still wouldn't be afraid, because I would feel like, okay, you know, I got resources to get out of this. I understand the system. And then it just made me aware of like, whoa, there are people born in Canada, living in Canada, mm-hmm. who are afraid of people and institutions that are meant to protect them. And like, this is messed up. This is messed up. Like that was just kind of like my takeaway of like, whoa, like this is happening. Like this is not like on TV. This is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So I know when this was being posted a lot on social media, there was all these big long book lists and different things like that. And that could be over. I mean, reading is great. Big long 20 reading list, unless you're in graduate school, might be overwhelming. Do you have a couple books you could recommend to someone that's maybe like starting on this journey? Podcast or a good website or?
Yes, I do. So I would stay away from the academic books. Mm-hmm. There is an episode of a podcast. I think it came out 2 days ago. I just listened to it. It's called a Salon B podcast. The episode is titled Reading Against Racism.
Okay.
Vegan Collection. It was really good. It featured, I think, 4 writers who were included in the collection, and they kind of addressed their walk, steps they've taken to address racism. That was a really interesting episode, but it's more academic.
Okay.
But that's what I have. Then for lighter reads, there's this book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa.
Okay.
I think it's a good intro into colonialism, imperialism, and that's good. That's good background information. That's good knowledge to have. slavery, that's a very good way to get introduced into such historic topics, because that kind of informs how you think about racism, how you try to identify yourself, how you try to negotiate your identities, so to say. That's a very good one. I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and that also changed how, it changed how I viewed the, I don't say the American society, because a lot of issues that he addressed also apply elsewhere, but for the most part, it was focused on racism in America, and that, that also really shaped how I think about issues of racism. And then just two authors that I go to every day, Angela Davis and Maya Angelou. So for Maya, her poems, there's this one, And Still I Rise.
That one's really well known.
It's world class. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is also her autobiography. And then for Angela Davis, just really anything that she's put out there, anything she's put out there is gold, particularly because she takes an intersectional perspective. So she focuses on women and class and gender and the prison system. So that's also something she does, which I think is very interesting. She talks about incarceration and the history of Black people being incarcerated at a very crazy rate, and eventually argues for the abolition of prison systems in the US and largely the world. I think that she really makes some really, really, really interesting arguments. So those are two other people that maybe somewhat lighter in terms of activism, but it's definitely really good. It's really good stuff there. So yeah, that's what I have.
Wow, that's a ton. That's like five resources, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, they're all really, really valuable stuff.
Yeah. So thanks again for another informative, thoughtful, intellectual discussion and being on our podcast. And, you know, once again, you can find out more about Jemima on our website, www.fow.ca. She'll be doing a couple writing tips. All those resources, we'll put the links on the website when we find out more about this University of Windsor program. We'll make sure to put it out there on social media, the website, the newsletter, wherever is appropriate. So, we just hope that this was informative and you'll be brave and keep fighting the fight, whoever you are, if this is something you care about. And just remember, it's a process. It's a process.
Yep.
So stay tuned, everyone, for a short meditation and writing exercise.
During this breathing meditation, you will focus on your breath. This will calm your mind and relax your body. There is no right or wrong way to meditate. Whatever you experience during breathing meditation is right for you. Don't try to make anything happen, just observe. Begin by finding a comfortable position, but one in which you will not fall asleep. Sitting on the floor with your legs crossed is a good position to try. Close your eyes or focus on one spot in the room. Roll your shoulders slowly forward and then slowly back. Lean your head from side to side, lowering your left ear towards your left shoulder and then your right ear toward your right shoulder. Relax your muscles. Your body will continue to relax as you meditate. Observe your breathing. Notice how your breath flows in and out. Make no effort to change your breathing in any way. Simply notice how your body breathes. Your body knows how much air it needs. Sit quietly, seeing in your mind's eye your breath flowing gently in and out of your body. When your attention wanders, as it will, just focus back again on your breathing. Notice any stray thoughts, but don't dwell on them. Simply let the thoughts pass. See how your breath continues to flow deeply, calmly. Notice the stages of a complete breath, from the in-breath to the pause that follows, the exhale, and the pause before taking another breath. See the slight breaks between each breath. Feel the air entering through your nose. Picture the breath flowing through the cavities in your sinuses and then down to your lungs. As thoughts intrude, allow them to pass and return your attention to your breathing. See the air inside your body after you inhale, filling your body gently. Notice how the space inside your lungs becomes smaller after you exhale and the air leaves your body. Feel your chest and stomach gently rise and fall with each breath. Now as you inhale, count silently. One. As you exhale, count. One. Wait for the next breath and count again. One. Exhale. One. Inhale. One. Exhale. One. Continue to count each inhalation, exhalation as one. Notice how your body feels. See how calm and gentle your breathing is and how relaxed your body feels. Now it is time to gently reawaken your body and mind. Keeping your eyes closed, notice the sounds around you. Feel the floor beneath you. Feel the clothes against your body. Wiggle your fingers and toes. Shrug your shoulders. Open your eyes and remain sitting for a few moments longer. Straighten out your legs and stretch your arms and legs gently. Sit for a few moments more, enjoying how relaxed you feel and experiencing your body reawaken and your mind returning to its usual level of alertness. Slowly return to standing position and continue with the rest of your day, feeling re-energized.
Hello everyone, welcome to today's writing exercise. In this episode, we talked about the Bystander Initiative and anti-Black racism. It's just a brief summary of what we discussed. For those wondering what it means to be an ally and how to be an effective bystander, there are three things you need to take note of. First, you need to acknowledge how racism has shaped you. This is perhaps, I think, the most difficult part of doing allyship. Next, you need to educate yourself on Black history, Black education, and there is so much information out there. You just need a simple Google search to provide you really valuable knowledge on what it means to stand up and fight against anti-racism or anti-Black racism. Last but not the least, you need to speak up and do your part. We know that most people refrain from direct expressions of racism, but they would often condone, overlook, or be patently unaware of the ways in which our institutions contribute to social exclusion. So for today's writing exercise, I want you to take a piece of paper and reflect on these 3 points for the next 3 minutes. First, you need to think of an act of anti-Black racism that you witnessed. Second, did you intervene or not? And how did it make you feel? And lastly, in the future, what would you do differently? Thank you.